We're in Ecclesiastes. We're going to kind of do an outline tonight, look at a few things. I don't want to say it's a difficult book, but it's a book that if you don't handle it right, you can let a lot of things slip through your fingers, a lot of treasures, a lot of insights. And so I want to be real careful with it. I've got on here, on your notes, two pages of notes, there's three charts on there. Those I just cut and pasted right off the internet. You can see I've got the links right there online. When these are online, those blue links will be live. They'll take you right to these sites. But what's interesting there is you can see three different, I don't want to say opinions, but different ways of dividing it up. If we all compared our Bibles, you know, the different breaks, the Bible breaks probably wouldn't match. Because sometimes, you know, some people put the break and say they're talking about money here, and over here they're talking about other people, those verses will overlap or they'll insert a different category. So there's the different ways of breaking this down. There's not like a divine there is a divine outline, but just like so many things, we don't necessarily have the exact outline. How does it break? So if you want to, let's just look very quickly at the bottom of the first page there. There it says, Ecclesiastes, life is vain, or is it? And that's kind of one of the themes of the book, is meaningless. And I guess one thing I think that we're going to see, that I anticipate to see in this, and a lot of times when you anticipate to see something, that's what you see, is that Solomon, or the writer, again, we talked about the writer is Koheleth, which means the one who calls the assembly. An easy translation, but weak, is teacher or preacher. I was going to show you this. If you look at your word Ecclesiastes, I mean, you guys should pick this up right away. It's the Greek word, which means assembly or call the assembly. Or in Koheleth, means the one who calls the assembly. That's the Hebrew word. Ecclesiastes is the Greek word for the Hebrew translation of Koheleth. What do you recognize that word? What does it look like? You do recognize this. If you go to the New Testament and we start studying the word church, church is a translation of the Greek word ecclesia. You're familiar with this, right? So ecclesia, right there. Ecclesia, which means the assembly, the called out ones. That is what ecclesia means. When Jesus says, I will build my ecclesia, he's going to build his called out ones. And in the Greek, the word ecclesia means, like, if you were all a community of people, say you're West Des Moines, we would choose those that were going to be on the committee for, you know, the water department. You know, we choose you. The called out ones are going to be on this group or this committee for the whole assembly, the called out ones out of the assembly. And so when Jesus says, I'm going to build my church, he's saying, I'm going to build my group, I'm going to call my people out and assemble them into, we call it church. We have church buildings, we have church. And again, this is a lot, it's a Greek word with a lot of history, a lot of meaning behind it that just gets so diluted, it's just natural, diluted when we show up for church on Sunday. And church is what? Well, it's you dress up the best, you know, you have the music, you have a service, you know, you watch the football game after church. It's like, yeah, that has nothing to do with the Greek meaning of the word, except you've got a group that assembled together. They were assembled for a purpose, and a lot of times they were assembled for a purpose of serving the community that they were called out of. But anyway, that's the word ecclesia. It means assembly, and that's what you see right here. Koheleth is the one who calls the assembly. He's the one who organizes, calls the assembly. We translate, like we said last week, teacher, preacher, because you call people for an assembly to dispense them with information or wisdom or preach to them. But Koheleth is the one who calls the assembly, almost as if Jesus, again, when you tie what he says in Matthew, when he says, I will build my church, Jesus almost is stepping in and saying, I am Koheleth. I am the one who's going to call the assembly. And we're going to have a meeting. Again, I'm not making a connection there at all, but it's very similar. So anyway, that's the word Koheleth, and that's where we get our word Ecclesiastes from. Now, what I was going to say, what I think we're going to see in here, and because the meaningless, vanity is the theme throughout this, I think we're going to see mankind, and Koheleth, I was going to say this, Koheleth at one point is going to say, men are no better than the animals, or they're like the animals. They live, they die, they don't see anything. Who knows what happens to them? Now, it sounds, again, as we go this, it depends on how you approach it when you get there. Is Solomon considering evolution? Is Solomon losing his faith? Or is Solomon simply saying, man, and this is kind of where I'm going to go with it, and I may change as we go through this, is man is on this side. He cannot see. He's blocked off from the true reality. He's over on this side. Even Paul says we live by faith, not by sight. Because with what we see, if really all the world is what we see, then the secular humanists have it right. We've got to, the survival for the fittest. We're living for right now today. Make money, have a good time, because when we die, it's over. So we're no better than the animals. Who knows what happens? Well, Solomon clearly knows what happens a little bit because he's seen God himself. He's built the temple. But he's talking about in man's state, in man's natural state, he's blocked off. He cannot see beyond the natural realm. And I mean, unless you've been visited by an angel or had a vision, we are blocked off. We can test certain things. We can argue about evolution. We can argue about how creation came about. But I mean, we use the Bible for a reference to the bigger picture. But in reality, none of us have seen Jesus. None of us necessarily have seen some supernatural event. I believe in it. I embrace it. But Koheleth is talking about man over here. And so he's facing, listen, if you look at it this way, it's going to be vanity. I mean, who knows? He's going to talk about, and we get going through here, he's going to talk about oppression. It's like, life's not fair. I mean, how can this be? Well, he says, yeah, but we don't know what happens. We don't know what happens after you die. Meaning, it even goes almost into the Greek philosophy that because life is so oppressive and life is not fair, that's one of the proofs of there must be something behind the curtain. Because even nature is balanced. Mathematical formulas have to be balanced. There has to be equality to help for creation to continue. There has to be some kind of balance. And sometimes in society, sometimes in culture, sometimes in a man's life, it's not balanced. The good die, the wicked prosper, oppression isn't dealt with, there's injustice. So humanity's not balanced. So that means, if we're going to take that concept, there must be something beyond what we see. So it's almost philosophical in the sense that we don't know everything. So yes, indeed, it is vanity for man, but realize you need to start thinking about the fact that it's not vanity, that it does have a purpose, that things are going to balance out. So instead of saying, I'm going to get my share now, I'm going to be abusive now, I'm going to do what I need to survive now, is think, God is going to hold you accountable for every decision you make, if it's good or bad, if it's done in public, if it's done in secret. He's going to say that. So it's like, before you start jumping into the vanity cycle, maybe you want to think, it's not vanity. It will be equalized. So what you sow, you may not reap today, but what you sow, you will reap. There's going to be a harvest. So again, be careful when you start just throwing this off, say, Solomon lost his faith. Solomon or Koheleth may be looking at life from the man's point of view, say, okay, if we look at it from here, this is what it looks like. But let me tell you, that's not all there is. There's something here. And he's going to eventually say, there's no end to discussing the things that are over here. And he's going to say, there's no end to writing books. Because it's like, once you start talking about these things, you can never, our human experience over here is limited. So we can keep talking about over here forever, and at the end, you still don't know what you're talking about because you've never gone there. You're just talking in circles, an endless circle. And so have enough wisdom to realize, okay, we're done speculating. You can spend all your life over here speculating about what's on the other side of the curtain. So let's just focus here and realize, basically what he says, let's live by faith and not try to solve all the problems because we don't even understand what's on the other side of the curtain. We live by faith. We do what's right, knowing God will hold us to account. How that happens, I don't know. When that happens, I don't know. But I know it's going to happen. So eat, drink, be merry today, and do what's right because Judgment Day is coming. When, where, how? Stop asking questions. I mean, that's basically stop asking questions. We don't know the answers. And it's kind of frustrating. You can almost hear the frustration in the teacher's voice as he goes through this because he wants to. If you go back and read about Solomon, he wrote about the plants that grew in the wall. He wrote about all the animals. He wrote about everything. He had the economy figured out. If it was physical, he figured it out. If I can figure out the economy of Israel, I figured it out. If I can figure out the plants, I figured out how to plant. He's got gardens. He's got vineyards. I've got the best wine. He had the best women. It's like, I've got everything figured out. Well, what about, okay, now we're talking about things I can't figure out. And I've tried. He's saying right here, basically, I tried to figure out why there's oppression and we can't get rid of oppression. I tried to figure out why some men are good and then they get these things and they die young and they never get to experience them. What is this all about? I don't know. So, I mean, Solomon realized, I think, or at least Koheleth, as he's speaking here, realized his limits. Okay, with that brief introduction, let's just look at the bottom chart just so we get this person's view here. It's from Words of Grace. Chapter 1, verses 1 through 11, life summarized, all is vanity. I'm at the bottom of page 1. Then verses 112 through chapter 6, so the first, basically first half of the book. Vanity is proven from experience and by observation. The author is going to say his thesis statement is life is vain. Then he writes six chapters about, yep, you see, life is vanity. There's no point to it. And then here's vanity counseled. And then now he spends the next chapters 7 through 12 saying, now, if you think life is vain, you still need to live wise. And he gives some wise advice, and we'll talk about it. It's a definite break between chapter 6 and chapter 7 with early on kind of complaining and discussing. And I don't think he's completely hopeless in those early chapters, but he does make a break. And in that second half, he starts dispensing wisdom again, saying, okay, if this is the way it is, this is how you should live. And then the very last, the conclusion here, life concluded, fear God and obey Him. Which kind of matches, you know, instead of just, it's not necessarily a blind faith, but it's a realization that we are living in a vain world, that if you're not careful, you're going to get sucked into vanity and live immoral. You're going to live foolish. You're going to live for today. And after you live and die, you're going to appear before God, and He's going to judge you for these things. And you're going to say, I didn't know there was a judgment at the end. Well, He says, I'm telling you, you may not understand it. You may not know where, when, or how, but there will be an evaluation. So, the best you can do today is fear God and obey Him. And then there's some breakdown underneath that. The next chart on the second page, you've got the book broken into two parts. The exploration and the exhortation. And again, that's similar. And again, you can see that break between chapter 6 and 7. Early on, he's talking about all is vanity, the vanity of doing and the vanity of having. Meaning, no matter how you live, no matter how much you've got, It slips through your fingers. You can't ultimately find all the answers in the things you do and the things you have. Then the exhortation. Well, because that is true, because chapters 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 are true, that you can't find fulfillment in this vain world, then you should have the exhortation in your vanity of being and using life well and the source of true living. So again, there's the explanation of life's inconsistencies, which I think is going to go back and say it's inconsistent here because you're only seeing half of the image. There's a whole other picture that we can't see taking place. And so when we say life isn't fair, life is vain, life is inconsistent, no, it's not. Because the Creator is just, the Creator is fair, the Creator is balanced. He is righteous and upholds righteousness. So in the end, no one's going to be able to stand and say life was inconsistent. It's going to be, no, it was exactly what it was supposed to be. Now again, we can't, and this is where some people get in trouble, they try to explain everything. Why did this happen? And you know, well, that evil thing happened in that person's life because, and then they begin to give all these reasons why. And it's like, well, then that evil thing happens to this person over here. That's a completely different person. Well, why did it happen to them? Because, well, this person lived immoral, they were on drugs, they had a bad history. Well, that happened to this person over here, too. So, were they on drugs and living immoral, too? It's like, well, no. God was... And you don't know, stop talking. You don't know these things. You know what I mean? And that's kind of where this is going to come out. It looks inconsistent, and instead of trying to explain, you just have to say, it looks inconsistent, but it's not. So you've got the answer? No. I'm just saying it's not inconsistent, We just don't know everything. Again, a frustrating place for the teacher to be because you want to answer all the questions. And then the very last one, it's got the, of course, everything starts with the introduction. Then it's got the investigation and the discoveries. And that's interesting because those early chapters is he's talking about his experiences, things he's seen and things he's tried to solve. In fact, he's going to introduce the book that way. We'll try to get there tonight. Right there in chapter 1, verse 13, it's got that reference there on that third chart. I set my mind to seek and explore wisdom. And again, if this is Solomon, he did. He measured and studied the plants. He measured and studied the economy. He measured and studied everything. But all of a sudden, he gets to a place where it's like, I can't measure and study this. I cannot write enough books about things I don't know. And then the admonition, a warning to the young, a picture of old age, which is a very fun chapter to read through unless you're old. And then the conclusion of the matter, again, fear God and obey Him. Because someday you will face him. So you kind of see the consistency there. Okay, let's go to the start of the book and the start of the outline I've got broken down here. And I'm not going to exhaust the text, but I do want to kind of skim through the text and kind of get a look at this. So at the beginning of Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, verse 1, it says, the words of the teacher, or Koheleth, the one who calls the assembly, son of David, king of Jerusalem. Now, again, we talked about this last week. It's pretty clear this is Solomon writing or Solomon's experience. It may be someone writing for Solomon or using this Koheleth, maybe a writer that's summing up Solomon's works. Again, that's just, I'm just presenting. I don't have a yes or no answer on that. The easy answer is Solomon's writing all of this. But the way it's written, it almost sounds like someone is writing from an outside position looking in at Solomon. Solomon could have done this himself and called himself Koheleth, or it could have been someone writing and taking all of this information. Here's the thesis statement, verse 2. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, or Koheleth, the one who calls the assembly. Utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. Okay. And that's a good place to start. I don't think that's the conclusion of the book. But again, he's making... One thing you got to watch with this is the writer of this, is he abandoning himself to these statements? Is he, when he says meaningless, meaningless, has he reached this point of frustration in his life where he's just walking away from life? Everything is meaningless. It doesn't look like it. It's like, it's almost like here's the thesis statement. Now I'm going to try my best to resolve that and solve that for you. Not so much, if really, my point, if this writer, Solomon or Koheleth, actually had hit that wall of meaninglessness, there would be no book of Ecclesiastes. He would have stopped writing. There's no point in it. He's been dealing with this, like I say, he's looking at life, and it's like, okay, looking at it from this side, I'm looking at it, I see meaninglessness. There's no point. Nothing works out the way you thought it would. It's not fair. There's oppression. It's meaningless. Okay, so, verse 3, here's he kind of begins now. I've got this at point A at the top. These are Koheleth's thoughts. He says, what does man gain from all of his labor at which he toils under the sun? What he's doing now is he's putting a foundation underneath his statement, meaninglessness. Well, what do you mean it's meaninglessness? Well, what I mean is I've seen people work and gain stuff, and at the end, they still die. I mean, what does it do? What good is life? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. Meaning, there's that cycle of vanity. It's like another day. It's like, what was the point? What did we accomplish yesterday? Nothing. We worked. We got tired. We went to sleep, and we do it again today. You probably had one of those jobs at some time in your life where you felt like that. It's like, I worked all day. I come home. I'm exhausted. I go to sleep. I get up. I eat. Why? So I go back to work. So I can come home and go to sleep. So I get up. It's like a kid working at a fast food place. It's like, I remember asking him. Different. I used to work at fast food places even when I had a family just to make money. I say, why you work here? I got a car. I got a car payment. Why do you need a car? So I can drive to work. Hey, I can solve your problem. You want to stay home and watch more TV? Don't. You have a job and don't have a car. Just sit at home. But it's like there was this cycle of, and it, you know, to them they wanted the coolness of having a car so you could drive to work and have a job. It's like, and but you know that's the teenager. But really, you step back and look at my life. It's like, it's a lot like that. It's just this. What do you call that? A gerbil on a spinning wheel. Anyway, the sun rises, the sun sets, and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south, turns to the north, round and round it goes, every turning in its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. I mean, what, and we understand all this. To the place the streams come from, there they return again, which some people try to make a big deal about that as far as evaporation, the water cycle. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. Meaning, he says, I'm expressing this right now, but he says, it's worse than I can even express. The vanity of life. The eye never has enough seeing. When is your eye ever full? Nor the ears full of hearing. Your ears just keep working. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. You're not going to do anything today that's never been done or feel something that's never now again. When we start going to the moon, we start talking about creating certain iPads or whatever, brand new. Okay, that's new, but something like that's already happened. For example, when we talked about the cuneiform going from being on tablets to being on cylinders, that was a big advancement. So there's many. Okay, what has been and will be again, what has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. There is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. In other words, you can't even say, well, that's never been done before, because there's been generations before you, and they may have done it. We just forgot what they have done. And again, I think there's a more of a truth to that. This, I think, is a philosophical argument. I don't know if you want to make this as far as statements of doctrine, because I think, you know, we have advanced as far as certain technologies. But at the same time, there's a lot of things that we have forgotten, people of other generations. We think we're the smartest generation, most advanced generation. I mean, you got to realize there's a lot of things happening back there, and he's making the statement. You can think that, you can say that. No one's had electricity until the 1900s or whatever. But it's like, you sure about that? Well, from what I got in my history books, right, but you weren't there. You don't know what they had, because we've already forgotten those people, and you'll be forgotten, and the people that are coming will be forgotten by the people that come after them. There's no point. It's just this endless circle. So again, all he's doing there is he's made his thesis statement meaningless, and now he's given you, I would not want to be in a room and raise my hand and start arguing with him right now. Say, well, I think I can find meaning. He says, your ear's never full, your eye's never full, the sun just keeps going around in a circle. It's like, nothing ever stops. I mean, I think you'd get, his argument is he's trying to build a case for his solid argument. Okay, so now that's his point, chapter 1, verse 12. If you look on the notes here, now comes the autobiographical introduction. Now he's going to introduce himself. He's introduced his thesis statement. He's built a foundation under his thesis statement with all kinds of examples, from the sun to the ears to the rivers to human history. Now he's going to say, this is me. And this goes from, this is verse 12, and it actually continues after he introduced himself up through verse 13 up through 26, where he begins his quest. Verse 12. I, the teacher, or Koheleth, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. Again, that lines up with what we see in the historical books of Solomon researching and writing and exploring, sending out ships to explore and bring back all kinds of animals and spices and treasures. People are coming to hear Solomon teach from other countries. So he devoted himself to study and to explore. And again, I'm going to say this. This book is about the things he could not finish. He finished his book on plants. He finished his book on Israeli economics. He finished his book on all the books that he's written. He finished the book of Proverbs, if you want to say that. But he's going to get to this point right here. These are the things. I started the book. I titled the book. I did the introduction, but I can't finish. I don't know these things. And it's a point of frustration. He says, I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. Or you could say on the earth, potentially. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Again, in his philosophical sense. If you want him to explain the economy, he can explain the economy. If you want him to explain how to build the temple, he can explain how to get a temple up and running. If you want him to explain how to set up an administration, I can tell you how to run an administration to rule a kingdom or an empire. But I'm now talking about some things that I've seen stuff that I can't explain. And if you keep trying to explain certain things, you're not. You're just chasing your tail. You're chasing after the sun. For example, verse 15, what is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. Now again, he can count money, he can count blocks of stone he's putting in the temple, but if it's not there, and we're talking about it, and even as we talk about eschatology or we talk about things that are in heaven and different views, there's a place where we just have to say, we're done teaching the Word and there's the Word of God, and there's things up here that we don't understand. We can talk about angels because they're referred to in here, but there comes a point where you've got to stop talking about angels because you're now making stuff up. You're speculating. Well, you can get a nice list of all the things, all the verses that talk about angels, but you can't talk about something you cannot see. You cannot talk about something you cannot measure and study and take apart and have a conversation with. You don't know. And that's what he's meaning right here. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. Or we could say, what you don't know, you can't talk about. If you've never seen it, you can't describe it. And even Paul went to heaven, apparently, went to the third heaven in 2 Corinthians, and came back and says, I saw things that men are not permitted to tell. He says, I saw things. What kind of things? I'll use the word twisted here because it's here. Things that are twisted, and I can't untwist them. I mean, there are things that I have no idea what I was looking at. And so, but that's what he's not talking about plants being unexplainable. He's not talking about the economy being unexplainable. He's talking about things that are twisted that man can't straighten this out. And that's a difficult thing. And we're in that age of anything is possible. But there are some things that God has twisted that you will never straighten out. There are things that are missing in our human experience that you can't count because they were never placed in our experience. They're not here. We need this. You're never going to find it. I thought to myself, look, I have grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem. You hear the teacher's frustration. He says, look, I am the smartest. I've written more books. I've done more research. I've sent out more exploratory teams, brought back more information. I've got more fact-finding teams. I've got statisticians. I've got research projects going. There's nobody like me. I can do this. He says, look, I've grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who's ruled over Jerusalem before me. I've experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. With much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more grief, or the more knowledge, the more grief. The more you study, the more you realize, I'm not going to figure this out. Well, let's go. And you just keep exploring. The further out you get, the more you realize, I'm beyond my capabilities. And so Solomon, it's one of those lies where, and that's why I think for some people, it's for me sometimes this way, I keep studying and doing things, but I like that where you just like, you stop thinking. You stop, you know, I'm going to mow my yard, I'm going to order a pizza, I'm going to watch a video, and I'm going to go to bed. I'm going to get up the next morning, I'm going to water my grass, I'm going to take my grandson around the block on his bicycle, and Grandpa, what is that? Well, I don't know, what do you think that is? It's like, just stop asking questions. You know, with a three-year-old or any kid, it's like it's nonstop wanting explanations. And I like it when they ask. I like it when you ask questions. Well, here, I can give you an answer. But three-year-olds don't always ask questions that you can answer. It's like, and if I can't, I can't explain it to you. It's like, and so what he's saying right here, I think he's expressing that in a different, or saying the same thing but on a different level. With much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. The more you realize that is out there, the more frustrating it becomes. Because he's eventually going to say, well, let's keep reading. Now, verse 2, or chapter 2. If you look on my notes here on point C, I got my lettering mixed up here, didn't I? Capital C, little letter B. Pleasure is the source of meaning, or pleasure as the source of meaning. And that's how we're going to talk about now, verses 2 through 1 through 11. I thought to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. but also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is foolish. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. My mind still guiding me with wisdom. I'm on an experiment here. Bring me another glass of wine. I'm doing an experiment. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. I mean, he got that poison of frustration. So let's go ahead and stop researching. Let's go have some fun. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. These are all things he could do. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves and flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and I had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women, singers. Now that's probably where you think about the Song of Songs. That might be part of where Song of Songs come. I acquired singers and songwriters, and they collected songs for me. We could add that possibly right there. And a harem as well. The delights of the heart of man. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. Again, he's not bragging so much as he's saying, I am the man. I've built it. I've owned it. I've seen it. There's no one like me. And yet, I am the one who's writing this book saying, I can't understand it. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasures. My heart took delight in all my work, and this was the reward for my labor. Yet when I surveyed all my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. I've just got a bunch of stuff. What did I do? I rearranged some rocks. I got some people organized. I've got fruit trees growing, and what's changed? Well, I've got to water the fruit trees. I've got to get more servants to take care of this because the fruit trees are. I've got fruit coming in. It's like there's no end to this. So now he concludes here with his pursuit of pleasure and all these possessions. Wisdom and folly are meaningless. When I turn my thoughts to consider wisdom and also madness and folly, what more can a king's successor do than what has already been done? I saw that wisdom is better than folly, of course, just as light is better than darkness. The wise man has eyes in his head while the fool walks in darkness. But I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. So now in verse 14, I think it's on the notes here. Yeah, right there. We're now going to be talking about all the things. He now begins to move into that area of things you can't control. Death is the great equalizer. So this man was wise. He lived a wise life. This man was foolish. This man lived his life in light. This man lived his life in darkness. Okay, so what's the point? Well, he says, the wise man, it says in verse 15, or middle of verse 14, I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. Then I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. Meaning, I'm a wise man. I'm the one writing the books, doing all the research, and I know that this man is a fool, and he's going to die and perish. Oh my gosh. I'm going to die and perish. Meaning, no matter how foolish he lives and no matter how wise I am, we both have the same fate. So that's right there. It's like, explain that. Well, eventually he's going to say, I think there's something going to happen beyond death. Then I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will also overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I just spent more time working, organizing, laboring. I said in my heart, this too is meaningless. Being wise, what is the benefit? It didn't overcome death. For the wise man, like the fool, will not be long remembered. In the days to come, both will be forgotten. Like the fool, the wise man too must die. So now he's talking about leaving a legacy where people remember all the great things. Now, of course, because of the scriptures, we remember who Solomon is. But yet, do we? I mean, we've got references to him, but we know a little bit about him. Of all the great things he's done, the things he said right here, we know very little about what he's accomplished. I mean, like for the temple that he built, nothing remains of that. I mean, we think we may have found a few stones or something, a part of a wall. But it's like all the great things Solomon did, if it wasn't recorded here in the scripture, the great. I know how many guys like Solomon have come and gone. I know Jesus did say that no one was wiser than Solomon or dressed better than Solomon. But there's been other wise, great kings in other cultures, and they're gone. They're lost, and other great, wise people. Anyway, he says, like the fool, the wise man too must die. Well, I don't want to just keep reading the book. I want to try to get a little bit of an overview of this. So beginning in verse 17, he now talks about, if you look on the notes here, chapter 2, verse 17, death neutralizes wisdom. And then he comes to verse 24, and this is kind of this is how he resolves this part of it. We'll come back and study this in more detail. Verse 24, he resolves it here by saying, a man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too I see is from the hand of God, which is very interesting. And this is one of those verses for me as a man who worked and had jobs and sometimes was frustrated because I was trying to create this or go here, become this, and I just had to get up in the morning and get on the treadmill and just grind it out. It's like right here. This is kind of, and Solomon's saying it here. I think this in a positive way. When you don't understand, when you're trying to be wise, you're trying to, and things you don't, you're just living your life day by day. Listen, he says, you don't know everything that's going on. So a man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. I mean, eat, that doesn't mean eat, drink, and be merry and party, until you kill yourself. But it's like you go to work, enjoy your job. When you come home, you get something to eat, enjoy your meal. If it's lunchtime, enjoy your lunch. Enjoy what you're doing. He says this, and find satisfaction in his work. He says, this too I see is from the hand of God. If you can somehow, in this meaningless world of this treadmill life, the sun coming and going, the water just continues to go to the oceans, you're one of those people. You're going to live and die and vanish from history, and no one's going to remember you. Well, you can get all bummed out about it, and what's the point of life, and there's no meaning. Or you can say, hey, I am here today. God has placed me here today. I don't understand these things, so I'm going to get up. I'm going to go to work. I'm going to do my job. When I get something to eat, I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to get a Coke or something, enjoy the Coke. It's like, that's what God has given me. I can taste the Coke. I can enjoy my job. I can enjoy being productive and creating something, so I'll do that. It's like, well, you shouldn't be having fun in life. Well, this is what God has given me. I can't have fun in eternity. I don't even understand the spiritual dimension. I can't answer why there's oppression, but I can say, that was fun today, and I'm going to get to do it again tomorrow. It's like, that is, again, in other words, saying, enjoy. You are living in a world, you can call it vanity if you want to, or you can embrace it and enjoy the part that you do understand. I think man is very complicated. There's many things that we don't even understand as far as the soul and eternity. But we do understand this world we live in, the things we touch, the things we experience. It's like, well, do it. Explore them. Develop them. I'll read it again. A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This, too, I see is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? Now again, some people would say that's negative. You shouldn't enjoy life. You should be a Christian and be suffering. Now I believe in suffering. I think the suffering comes not in self-afflicted wounds. It comes from, like we talked about, persecution. When you're testifying and the world of vanity is oppressing you for saying there's something bigger and better, they're bringing you persecution. That's the kind of suffering. Jesus suffered that kind of persecution. Jesus didn't go around and just make his life miserable. Jesus enjoyed, I think, his life. I mean, they accused him of having too much fun at different times. So there's nothing Christian, there's nothing super spiritual about beating yourself up and being miserable all the time. And sometimes people get into that. But there is something to be said for suffering for the sake of Christ, but at the same time, being able to enjoy your life. For without him, the writer says, without him, who can eat and find enjoyment? To the man who pleases God, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. And I think that can be explained to the man who pleases God. If you are looking for God and willing to live your life before God, you will find pleasure in your life. And you've met people like this. You've met people who were discontent with God. They were discontent with life. They hated their job. They hated everything. And they just continued to just spread discontentment through their life. But they rejected God, and that continued through their life. Where you find people that accept God, they accept their place in life, and all of a sudden, they start enjoying the sunset. They start enjoying, when they have to stop and get gas, it's like, oh, I got to get gas. Stop and get gas and talk to the guy at the next pump. I mean, it's like, well, you're having a good time. Yeah, because this is where God has put me. I'm enjoying where I'm at. So I think that explains this. To the man who pleases him, has faith, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. And that's not like this supernatural knowledge. That's just knowledge and wisdom to enjoy what you're doing. Relax. Have fun. But to the sinner, the discontent who doesn't please God, who rejects God, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. In other words, it's like all you're doing, you're just trying to collect it, but you have no purpose for it. I mean, we're both living in this meaningless cycle of life, but one person can enjoy it. The other person is trying to accumulate stuff to find meaning. It's like, you're not going to find meaning in accumulating this stuff. You're just going to accumulate stuff in your attempt to find meaning. And then when you die, it's going to be handed to somebody here. You want this? Because they're gone. And someone else is going to use it that knows how to enjoy it. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. In chapter 3, and as we continue this overview probably next week, the next point right here, in verses, say, 3, that's a mistake right there where it says, in point D, 3, 1 through 6, 9. I originally wrote it, but I changed it. That should be going down to verse, that should be like 3, 1 to 3, 22. This next part right here, through this next chapter, is a quest for the right time. And then we're going to have a quest for justice, to get rid of oppression. Now, I'll see if I can sum this up right here. And what he's going to say, I'm trying to find the verse that kind of sums this up. He's saying there's a place for, it goes back to Romans chapter 8. Everything works together for the good of those who love the Lord. If you love the Lord, you just keep on going. And somehow things will all work out. It's not magic. It's because God's got a plan. This is going somewhere. You may not see the plan. And so what he's saying here is he's saying there's a time. It's the I got in my notes, the quest for the right time and the quest for justice. In verses 1 through 15, the reality of the right time. He describes here that there is a right time for everything. And it's in God's hands. Let's go ahead and just read this. There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under heaven. Again, this is not necessarily us knowing what it is, but it's God doing things at the right place at the right time. Our job is just to be there and do them. Be there and live by faith, not necessarily created. Time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant, a time to uproot. A time to kill, a time to heal, a time to tear down, a time to build. A time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones, a time to gather them. A time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to search, and a time to give up. A time to keep, a time to throw away, a time to tear, a time to mend, a time to be silent, and a time to speak, a time to love, and a time to hate, a time for war, and a time for peace. What does the worker gain from his toil? I've seen a burden of God, the burden God has laid on men. He has made everything, here it is, he has made everything beautiful in its time. So you may say, that's not the right time, or this is the wrong event, but when God is in control, that everything at the right time is beautiful. He says he has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. And that's kind of where we're at. That's a good place to kind of quit somewhere in here, because that's the idea. We know there's something bigger about us than just, if we look at the world, if we were an animal, we would not ask the question, what's the purpose? I can't even understand what you mean by the word purpose. I'm a dog. You just live your life. I mean, you eat, drink, and be merry, for I'm a dog. You know, it doesn't matter. But man begins to ask these questions. There's got to be more to life than eating and rolling in the grass and sleeping all day and then barking all night. It's like, what's the point? Man asks those kind of questions. Why does man ask those questions? Right here. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men. There's something in us that we know. There's something bigger. That's why we get frustrated with the minuteness of life, the vanity of life. That's why the book is being written. There's something bigger going on here. Yes, but just trust God and just enjoy what he's showing you to do. Go to work, enjoy your food, enjoy your life, and do what's right. Because, right here, although he set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning. okay, I'm created for eternity, and so I've got this hunger, this unsettledness, that there's something bigger. It's like, right, God has created you. You're an eternal being. Cool. So why don't I understand anything? There's a purpose for everything. There's a right time. There's a time to pick up stones. There's a time to throw stones away. There's a time to be frustrated and say, I don't understand eternity. Because there's going to be a time where you will understand eternity. So just wait. There's a right. Your frustration, it needs to be tempered. You don't want to write a book and get all, you know, frantic about it. It's meaningless. And write all kinds of crazy philosophies that destroy societies because you can't figure this out. And what comes back to that ideal of the fullness of Christ. When you understand the fullness of Christ, it's not hard for us to say something bigger is going to happen. There's eternity on the other side. I don't understand it. We can read the Bible, I can teach the Bible, but if I don't teach the Bible, I don't have any answers other than the Scriptures. It's not like I've got this great wisdom. I'm not going to create a philosophy. We can't go there. We don't know what is there. So He has made everything beautiful in its time, although we do not always know when that time is. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men, meaning they taste something, they sense something, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning. They can't put their... It's like a scratch or an itch you can't scratch. I know that there is nothing better for men than to be happy and do good while they live. He says, the best thing I can tell you, are you happy? You need to learn to be happy. And right here, here's your Joel Osteen verses right here. When you know God, you love God, you can be happy and you can have your best life now because you understand this is all I can get. I can only do this. I'm waiting for something bigger. Be happy and to do good while they live. You can do good and you can be happy. So today, do good and be happy because that's what God has given you to do. But I've got questions. Why is life not fair? Right, we don't know. And then he goes on and says, I know that there's nothing better for men than to be happy and do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil. This is the gift of God. I don't think he's being sarcastic about that. I don't think this is a hopeless state. Well, he needs to know Jesus. It's like the man is saying, I can't know any more than I've been told. So God has designed it so every man can enjoy eating, drinking, and working. It's a gift from God. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing can be taken from it. There's your revelation of God. There's your word of God. That's the eternity of Jesus Christ. God does it so that men will revere Him. Whatever is has already been and what will be has been before, and God will call the past to account.
I'm going to quit because I'm running out of time. But I'll pick this up and we'll talk more about this, obviously. But look in verse 22. His conclusion here. So I saw that there's nothing better for a man than to enjoy his work because that is his lot. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? I can't tell you the future. I can't tell you what's going to happen on the other side. But I can tell you this is what we need done today. This is what we're serving for a meal. So you can enjoy your work. You can enjoy your meal. Enjoy the conversation because this is what we've got today. Well, I'm disgruntled. Well, you need to not be disgruntled because God has given us this. In other words, the vanity part is almost the ideal of stop trying to make things bigger than they are. You are a man. You're living at this time in history. Get a job. Pay your bills. Do what's right and enjoy your life. Well, what about, and of course, we can go off on, you know, what's right and what's wrong and spiritual salvation, all that. But as far as the man, your life, eat, drink, and do what's right and enjoy the life God has given. There's nothing wrong with enjoying life. So again, you can see how that can go negative real fast. But I think Solomon's looking at the negativity saying, yeah, I know what it looks like, but there's something bigger here. This is all we see. So stop calling this negative. Stop saying this is oppressive. Stop saying this is vanity because... just because it looks vanity, just because it looks like it's oppressive, doesn't mean it is. Just enjoy. Trust God and engage in life. Trust God and live life. And that's for me, that was a huge thing to learn because when you start being religious, you start being Christian, for me at least, you try to fall into that Christian pattern, the religious mode, and it just got so, I don't know, oppressive. It got so... you know, well, yeah, Christians got to be like this and Christians got to do this. It's like, I eventually just walk away from that whole religious mess and just say, hey, I'm gonna find the Creator, I'm gonna find the Savior, and ask some questions. And life kind of taught me some of those things, as it has probably you too, of just that feeling of being in the treadmill. What do you call that rat cage? What's that wheel called? The spinning wheel. What, you get a gerbil running on it. What's it called? It's a real simple. I mean, I should know it. Wheel, a rat wheel. It's not a rat wheel. But, you know, you watch them run. They run. And it's kind of like, hey, and they're having fun, you know. So it's Monday morning. Go to work and get on that treadmill and start running and enjoy it while you're there. It's like, hey, and I'm almost ready to go back to school. Because I'm about ready to get on the treadmill again. All right, well, hey, thank you for being here. We'll pick this up. And I'm trying to clean it up. I'm kind of trying to do an overview. Each of those verses, we can stop and do more detail on them. But I'm trying to get an overview of the feel for the book yet. So, okay, I'll pray, and then you're dismissed. Father, we thank you again for your truth. We thank you for your word. We thank you for the Spirit that abides within us that will help us understand these things. We do ask that your Spirit would enlighten us to just do the simple things in life as far as enjoying life and taking care of the responsibilities you've given to us and not get bogged down in all the difficult questions and the complexities of things that we don't understand or have the ability to understand. But leave those in your hands. And just as Job and so many others learned, that we just trust you, we love you, and you'll take care of the rest, Father. We do thank you for letting us enjoy life and giving us the earth and all the fellowship we have here to, again, to share your goodness with others and in life. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you again for being here.